Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. LinkedIn is the world's largest professional network, putting its members at over 1 billion. They just released a new grad guide, highlighting what new graduates are looking for and who's looking for them. What should you be looking for, and what is LinkedIn's role in the job search sphere? Here to talk about it is Andrew McCaskill, a LinkedIn career expert and one of PR Week's top 40 under 40 PR executives. Welcome to Tech Tuesday, Andrew.
Hey, I'm so excited to talk to you today.
So if you had one thing to say to the hundreds of thousands of recently graduated college students, what would it be about the current job market right now?
Congratulations and gird your loins. I mean, it's true though. I mean, new graduates are facing, you know, unemployment, higher unemployment rates. Hiring is down by almost 10%. And you know, there are more people who graduated in this graduating class than graduated in previous years, and some of those folks from previous years are still out there looking, but it is going to be a strategy play, and there's a bunch of things that people can do to set themselves up for success and beat the odds.
So let's talk about those things. You created this new grad guide. What would you say the main focus should be for a new graduate?
I think the main focus should be a mindset shift, is that the number one, that your first job out is probably not going to be your dream job, but it could set you on the path to a great career. You're going to have to be really adaptable, and you're going to have to use all of the tools in your toolkit to get hired and to find places where you're going to be able to grow. And so the first thing is be adaptable. Think about it as an adventure in this next part of your sort of job search. Look at opportunities and go where the growth is. So we sell job seekers. What we're going to help you do is we're going to tell you what industries are. Think about it like this. We've looked at the top industries that are currently hiring. Construction is hiring. Utilities are hiring. Oil, gas, and mining. Financial services. Now, Some of these industries may not be, you know, the sexiest industries in the world, but the workforce in these industries is getting older. They're leaving those roles and opportunities, and it's making a lot more opportunity for young people to come in and take those jobs, right? So that's really, really good news for those younger people, because there's going to be a lot more of those companies are going to be recruiting more heavily. They're going to be potentially giving them more responsibility than they may have gotten if they had gone into another industry. And the nation's largest, you know, refining system, Marathon Petroleum, is headquartered right there in Ohio. BMW Financial Services is headquartered in Ohio, which is a financial services company, Nationwide Mutual. All of those companies are, some of those financial services companies that are hired are in Ohio. So that's good news for a lot of people in the central Ohio area.
Now, some of those industries that you said are the fastest growing, construction, the oil and gas industry, those require a very particular set of skills. Are they willing to hire a recent college grad who maybe has a degree in the humanities and train them?
Well, and here's the deal, is that I think that's one of the things that grads have to start thinking about, too, is that, listen, you may say, well, there's a very specific skill set for construction or utilities or oil and gas or financial services or even, you know, wholesale trading. But those are really dynamic industries, and they're hiring for everything. They're hiring for marketing. They're hiring for communications. They're hiring for project management. They're hiring for tech roles, right? And so don't just think that a construction gig is going to be a job where I'm going to be putting on a hard hat every day, or that I have to know architecture or that sort of thing. There's a lot of opportunities within that. Just go and start looking in those industries and start looking at those companies and do your search in that way.
There's been a lot of talk here in Ohio about the growing data centers. You know, we're building one for Intel. Whether or not Intel's around, you know, that's a whole nother topic. But we're building data centers. We have Amazon, Google, Meta. They're building them. But a lot of these buildings don't need a ton of people, but I guess they need people to build the buildings. Are you seeing that in whenever you are making something like a grad guide, where there are a lot of these data heavy things happening, but they don't have a ton of jobs associated with them?
absolutely seeing.
Drew, I think you're breaking up a little bit. I think, did we lose you?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, I hope you can hear me. I was saying we're absolutely seeing that there's a ton of opportunities, roles, and interests in those fields. With 35% of job seekers say it's challenging to determine if they're a good match for a job. And so as we're seeing those construction roles for like those data centers, there's a bunch of other sort of roles in the food chain to get those data centers up and running that are where there might not be a lot of people in those data centers, but there are a lot of people that are required to get those data centers up and running. So look for those jobs and then use tools like job matching tools on places like LinkedIn to help you figure out where the opportunities are in those industries that you may haven't thought of before.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking about how LinkedIn is trying to help new graduates navigate the current job market with Andrew McCaskill, a LinkedIn career expert. So it's hard to predict. I can't make you predict the future, but are there any industries that you see taking off in the next 5 to 10 years that maybe certain students in high school should be looking at for their college career? What's the most growing industries in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think more so than what's the most growing industry is, I think what's the most growing innovation, and I think that's where job seekers should start to look at. And the AI assisted workforce is a real thing. The AI assisted workforce is happening now, and AI is your invitation into the market, into the game, and it's your invitation towards growth. Right. So what I say about AI assisted workforce is that more and more, all jobs, all roles are going, there's going to be some modicum of expectation that you're going to be able to use AI to help you do that job better. And so the thing that I think that everyone should be doing now is that AI literacy is the number one most in-demand skill across every industry that we're looking at on LinkedIn right now. We've done a ton of stories about it. We even have our 10 most taken AI courses on LinkedIn Learning available for free for anyone who is on LinkedIn. You don't have to have LinkedIn Premium. I would suggest that for anyone who, whether you're in the job market right now or just thinking about your career over the next 5 years, take at least 5 of those courses, if not all 10 of them, because the expectation for people to be able to use AI to do their jobs better, more efficiently, faster, and at a higher quality, that is the trend and that is the innovation we should be following, because it's going to be across all industries.
And what are you seeing as far as location is concerned? Are there certain cities that are pulling in more people for jobs, or are you still seeing that trend of working remotely?
The trend for remote work and remote opportunities has greatly decreased. People are going back into the office. And for younger people, I think that's a good thing. If I had a son or a daughter who had just graduated from school, I would say go into the office, because you do so much better to make relationships in real life and in person than you can doing it remote. I'm an old guy. I'm about to turn 50. And so I've worked inside of an office, and I can tell any young person that sometimes relationships will save you when results won't. And so building those relationships, it is so much easier to do that when people can see you and you're in person and you're in office. But if we're talking about location, the Sun Belt is winning right now. And so what we're seeing is that, people are companies in places like Tucson, Arizona, Savannah, Georgia, Tallahassee, Florida, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Dallas, Texas. A lot of these cities don't have as many grads. And so that they're recruiting from other places. Those companies are recruiting people to come into the area. They're also paying better, oftentimes more competitive salaries, because they have to recruit outside talent to come into those areas. And in a couple of these states, there's no state income tax as well. So even for people who maybe have not advanced as far in the last 4 or 5 years, and they want to play catch up financially or even catch up in their careers, they're thinking about making that move to some of these cities that have really high hiring and high recruiting rates and really competitive recruiting strategies to get people to move to these places.
All right. I want to thank you for your time, Andrew McCaskill, a LinkedIn career expert. Thank you for joining us for Tech Tuesday today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the shifting diamond industry. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
Support for WOSU comes from thousands of listeners and from the Greater Columbus Arts Council, announcing the Columbus Arts Festival will once again grace the beautiful Columbus Riverfront June 6th through 8th. More information at columbusartsfestival.org.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. It used to be that that sparkler on a woman's left hand had to be a diamond. After all, as the song goes, diamonds are a girl's best friend. But maybe not anymore. At least not natural diamonds. There's a growing market for lab-grown diamonds. It used to take the Earth a few billion years to grow a diamond, but now a machine can do it in as little as 5 days. Paul Nimzinski is a diamond and jewelry industry expert. His research is used by many of the world's largest diamond jewelry and luxury companies, as well as federal governments, major financial institutions, and top universities. He also hosts a podcast on the topic. Welcome to All Sides, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
And sorry about that. I got your name all jumbled up in my mouth. I apologize. But Paul, can you tell me what exactly is a lab-grown diamond? How do you grow a diamond? When you think of a diamond, you know, the Earth needs a few billion years to grow one.
Yeah, so I guess I would just preface it with, you know, people that don't follow the industry as closely as I do. This technology has existed for actually a very long time. So we've been growing or producing synthetic or man-made diamonds since the 1950s and 60s. And up until about 20 years ago, almost all of that production was used for industrial use diamonds. So diamonds that are used in, say, mining equipment or construction equipment, or if you go to Home Depot and buy a tile saw blade, that's going to have synthetic diamonds. And the very large majority of that is produced in China. They've kind of been the leader in that area for decades now. And then if you kind of fast forward to maybe, you know, 2010, we started to see larger jewelry quality man-made diamonds enter the market. And that really picked up steam, I would say, around, you know, 2015. I wrote a research article in 2018 and I titled it The Year the Lab Created Diamond. So I would say, you know, at least over the last, you know, 5 to 8 years in particular, the product as a, you know, as a diamond that's actually used in jewelry has, you know, grown, you know, quite rapidly. It's become a mainstream product. So the takeaway is, you know, the technology has existed for, you know, quite some time, but it's just kind of been recent years that you started to see it available in a mainstream level. And that comes down to prices. So there's two ways that they primarily produce these diamonds. They try to, you know, recreate the conditions that are naturally found in nature. So it's, you know, they have these presses that use very high pressure and temperature to try to essentially squeeze carbon into a diamond. And then there's another technology that uses microwave technology to produce diamonds that way. And I would say both technologies have realized you know, rapid advancements in the production technologies. And this has also been driven by other industries that use, you know, for instance, the microwave technologies used by the solar industry and the LED light bulb industry. So the bottom line is these productions have been, you know, the advancements in the technology has been, you know, rapidly improving. And that's resulted in higher production volumes, but more importantly, much lower prices. And I think, at the end of the day, prices for lab diamond, they are maybe one-tenth the price of a natural diamond. That's ultimately what's driven the product to be mainstream. So again, they existed, 15, 20 years ago, but the price was essentially the same as a natural diamond. So that price differential, which is a result of the advancements in production technology, that's kind of really what's driven the lab-grown diamond, if you will, to be a mainstream product.
Now, do these lab-grown diamonds look and feel the same as natural diamonds? Like, to the naked eye, if you were just looking quickly, can you tell the difference?
Yeah, so it's chemically diamond. You probably are not going to be able to tell with the naked eye. I guess I'll just note that with some of these other colorless gemstones, whether it's moissanite or white sapphire or even like cubic zirconia in certain instances, you probably aren't going to easily be able to tell the difference. So this isn't a new dynamic for the industry, per se. But more often than not, you're going to want a professional, gemological lab like the GIA, which is the largest gem lab in the world. They're based in California. You want a company like that to verify, whether you're looking at a natural or manufactured diamond.
Now, you said that in recent years, the cost of lab-grown diamonds has come down, so therefore more people can afford them. Are people gravitating toward them? Do people want them? I guess is my question.
So I think the reality is, I think all else equal, I think most people would prefer a natural diamond that was, formed 1 to 5 billion years ago in the Earth's mantle. It was brought to the surface of the Earth by a volcano. I mean, it's a pretty romantic narrative, if you will. And I think, people like the idea of a diamond being a treasure of the Earth, if you will. So I think, when we're talking about luxury products here, I think if we're talking about diamonds used for, again, abrasive or industrial applications, I don't think the user really cares where it came from. They just want the cheapest one that performs the best. I think with jewelry, again, it's an emotional purchase. It's not necessarily a practical purchase. So I think the source origin does matter to a lot of consumers. I think, the question at this point becomes, given that the lab-grown version is so much cheaper than the natural version, consumers have somewhat of a difficult decision to make. It's like, you could buy a 1 carat natural diamond. It's going to cost you, $5,000 to $6,000 if we're talking a medium quality diamond. You can buy, the man-made version of that for, well under $1,000, probably, $500 or even less. So, at the end of the day, again, this comes down to price. And the way I like to look at it is it's another, option for consumers. And, for some consumers that, having a diamond that's natural and rare and valuable is, really important to them. And, especially if it's a gift like an engagement ring, they feel that makes it more special. But if you're just looking for, a diamond that's going to be beautiful, the lab grown version, could achieve that for you at a much, much lower price.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about diamonds, real ones and lab grown, with Paul Zimnisky, a diamond and jewelry industry expert. Now, Paul, I saw one example in a story from the public radio show Marketplace. They said that lab grown diamonds were visually and molecularly identical to mined diamonds, but a fraction of the price. So their example was a pair of 1 carat diamond earrings, which is roughly the size of a pencil eraser, would cost $3,000. But the lab-grown version costs $800. Are you seeing that as an example of, because I mean, you say, okay, maybe the engagement ring sounds like something that needs to be a real diamond because of the symbolic significance of getting married. But what about the earrings? Do they, can $800 is certainly less than $3,000.
Yes, significantly less. And to put this in context, so again, go back, 10 years ago, and the lab-grown version was maybe 10% less expensive than the natural. And today it's, 90% in cases even, greater than 90% less than the equivalent natural. So the price, dynamic has been, very, very volatile and very, fast moving. I think at the end of the day, if we look, where are we going to be 10 years into the future? I think, the price of most lab diamonds are going to be, well under $1,000. I mean, maybe some of them will be under $100. And I think you'll see the price of, natural diamonds will, remain in that, thousands of dollar price points and higher. So again, it's going to come down to, what's important to the consumer. And I think you make a good point. I think, for maybe a more special gift, like an engagement ring, that having a natural diamond is more important to some people. But if you're, buying a pair of earrings or a tennis bracelet, which if you're buying a tennis bracelet with, a lot of diamond carriage, it could be extremely expensive and maybe not affordable for a lot of people. So, a lab-grown version of, say, a tennis bracelet is something that would be more affordable.
Now, well-known jewelry creator De Beers recently announced that it's closing its lab-grown diamond business that they called Lightbox. This move is seen as a firm allegiance to natural gems, but also there was a big drop in price of those lab-grown diamonds, so maybe De Beers just wasn't making any money. What do you make of the De Beers announcement?
Yeah, so De Beers has always been, primarily a natural diamond entity. I think they kind of experimented with the lab-grown diamond. It was, if you just look at the amount of, capital expenditure they spend on their business, I mean, the lab diamond was probably, well under 5% of what they spend. I mean, they'll spend, billions of dollars to develop a diamond mine. I think they spend a couple hundred million on the lab diamond venture. So I think it was kind of more just maybe dipping a toe, into the water. I think they were ultimately trying to use maybe their distribution and their marketing, ability to maybe help communicate the difference between the lab-grown diamond and the natural diamond in consumers' minds. I think that's kind of been a challenge, from an industry standpoint, is kind of getting that communication right. I think, again, if you aren't, focused on this industry on a daily basis as I am, I think it's kind of confusing, what the two products really are. And I think a lot of people are still unsure, can you definitely tell the difference between the two? Can you not? So I think these are the sort of things that the industry kind of really has to kind of work through. And I think, it's going to take time, but I think we'll get to the point where most people understand, the differences. And, just as an anecdote, my mom's engagement ring was a manufactured emerald in the 1970s. And, she's an artist and she wanted a colored stone. And, natural emeralds, they tend to have a lot of inclusions, and she wanted a cleaner stone. So it kind of made sense for her at that time. And that was, I mean, what's the math on that? I mean, 40, 50 years ago. So, again, this isn't a brand new, phenomenon. I think what's new is how inexpensive the manufactured diamond product has become. That's kind of the new development here.
Now, the lab-grown diamonds, I mean, you mentioning the emerald made me think of this, but can you get them in different colors? I guess, because like a diamond, that the earth spent a billion years making, it comes as it comes.
Yeah, very good point. So, with manufactured gemstones, yes. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing. We can kind of produce, what we want. We can produce them the size, the color, the clarity, the shape. They're essentially made to order. And again, that's why the price point is so different. I mean, natural diamonds, the non-renewable natural resource, they're kind of available, in what nature gives us. With the manufactured version, we could produce them in a particular color, a custom color, a color that you wouldn't, find in nature. So, you could actually, have a green diamond, or you could have a, manufactured emerald or a ruby. So there's a lot more options. But again, the rarity factor is completely different.
Now, we're talking about lab-grown diamonds, but the lab can grow. Can you do lab-grown emeralds, lab-grown rubies, all of it?
Yeah, so the colored gemstone, again, they've been, available on a mainstream level for a long time now, for decades. So they were kind of the precursor. And you can go to your local jeweler and you could, probably find a beautiful 1 carat ruby or emerald, a synthetic or a manufactured version for, well under $100, probably $40, $50. And it's a nice piece of jewelry and it makes a nice gift. But if you want, the natural version of that ruby or emerald in a good quality, it's going to be thousands of dollars. So, again, this dynamic has been at play with, other types of gemstones in the past. And yes, those colored gemstones, I would say, include the sapphire with that as well. They've been, available for decades now. They kind of really went mainstream, I would say, like in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah. So, about 2 decades ago, there was a movie, Blood Diamond, that became popular. Do you think this movie had an effect on the popularity of diamonds, or made people think more about diamonds than they had in the past, and maybe that helped expand the lab-grown diamond industry?
Yeah, so that was a very popular movie starring Leonardo DiCaprio. I think that definitely, set a narrative in a lot of consumers' minds. What I will tell you is that if you talk to people that were in the industry around that time, they said the year that that movie came out was actually a good year for the natural diamond industry because people were thinking about diamonds. And they said, the diamond that I bought is not a blood diamond. It's a clean diamond. And that's kind of the way they were thinking about it. But I think just, they always say, the PR and the publicity is good. It's a sort of situation where I think people were thinking about diamonds because of that movie, and the natural diamond industry actually had a good year. The reality is, the very large majority of natural diamonds are produced by very large corporations that are heavily regulated. A lot of them are publicly traded companies. So it's really not, a problem this day and age. But if you go like further back into the past, yeah, I mean there was definitely diamonds that were produced in regions that were involved in civil conflict, and that's basically what that movie was based on. So I think from a marketing standpoint, what some of these lab-grown diamond companies have done is say, well, it's 100%, definitely not going to be a diamond that came from a conflict region since we produced it in this manufacturing facility or factory. So I think it's kind of been more of a kind of a marketing narrative more so than anything else. I mean, that really hasn't been an issue for the diamond industry for a long time.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask, are there still ethical concerns out there, or they basically have everything is certified now and it's not as much of a concern?
Yeah, I think the transparency is significantly better than it was in the past. I mean, I would urge consumer that is looking to buy a diamond, ask the troller, where it came from. They should be able to tell you that information. If they can't, maybe try someone else. Because the industry's worked quite diligently trying to increase the transparency, and we're getting to the point now where you're going to be able to tell the consumer where the diamond came from. And I think that actually makes the story around the diamond much more interesting if you kind of have that story.
Are there any ethical concerns with lab-grown diamonds?
So what I would say is the large majority of the lab-grown diamonds are produced in the Eastern world, I'd say mostly China and India. These are just manufacturing superpowers, and they've done a very good job getting the cost of production down, which is a lot of it has to do with economies of scale. So basically, the more you produce, the lower the per unit cost. So they've kind of like really taken this product and run with it. It's a question of how much energy does it take, right, to re you know to produce a diamond, and it requires a lot of energy. It re you know requires infrastructure build it. You still need mine materials to build the equipment. So I think kind of the narrative that lab diamonds are great for the environment, natural diamonds are bad, that's way too simplified. It's much more nuanced than that. I think for a consumer that's really really interested in say the environmental aspect of this, the best option is going to be a repurposed or recycled diamond. If you buy a diamond that was mined 50 or 100 years ago, it's not going to have any additional carbon footprint if you were to buy that. So that's kind of what I would urge the consumer that's really interested in that to look into. And the reason that's not more popular is just because there really isn't an advocate for it. The natural diamond companies want you to buy a new diamond, and the lab diamond companies want you to buy a new diamond. So there's really not anybody advocating for buying a secondhand diamond, even though that is the option that provides the lowest environmental footprint.
So for that low environmental footprint, where do I find old diamonds?
Yeah, I mean, so some trollers will have it. That's kind of the thing. It's like the industry really isn't incentivized to sell them. So it's not, as mainstream. But I think if you kind of do your work, you will find, secondhand diamonds available. There's some cool, vintage stuff where you can get an old diamond that was kind of recut, using newer technology. I mean, they are available, but it's not, unfortunately, it's not as easy, to find those as it is a new diamond.
Well, I guess we'll just end with, do diamond purists, a jewelry store or even a company as big as De Beers, do they hate lab-grown diamonds?
So I think they're kind of focused on th their product, right? And again, I think I think what's ultimately the saving grace for the diamond industry is that, again, it's a luxury product. It's an emotional purchase. It's not a practical purchase. People buy it because it makes them feel good. And for the same reason, people buy any luxury item, whether it's a high-end watch or a high-end handbag or a high-end pair of shoes. It's like it kind of makes you feel good, right? And it's I think it's kind of difficult to again replicate the idea that a natural diamond is multi-billion years old and it was brought to Earth through a volcano. It's kind of a pretty cool backstory, and it's more valuable because of that. And I think the cost of a luxury item definitely impacts the way that consumer perceives or feels about it. It's essentially the economic law of Veblen good. It's like the higher the price, the more desired it becomes because everybody can have it. You can't have as many as you want. So all of these factors are at play here, and that's kind of what makes it such an interesting industry to analyze.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. That was Paul Zimnisky, a diamond and jewelry industry analyst. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paul.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
And coming up, we're going to talk with Russell Hawley. We're going to hear about the Chromebook Challenge, which has turned out to be quite dangerous. That's when Tech Tuesday continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The Chromebook Challenge has emerged from children in schools and has, quite literally, sparked safety concerns. Also, a new gaming accessory has been announced by Razer, and Duolingo has made some major changes to its interface. We're going to talk about all those topics and more with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So let's start with that Chromebook challenge. So kids are sticking things into their laptop ports. Tell us why that is a bad idea.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So, everything about a Chromebook, just like any other laptop, runs on a battery. And, it delivers power to the USB ports across the laptop. We've kind of changed in technology over the last couple of years, and a USB Type-C port, that's the oval-looking one, will deliver power to that battery, as well as, if you plug a USB stick or, a printer cable or something into it. And I think there are a couple of frankly, probably bored kids that figured out the hard way that if you take paper clips or things like that and shove it in some of those ports, that it will cause, among other things, smoke to trickle out of that USB port. And there have been a number of kids who have caught this on video and shared it to TikTok to, get attention for this little bit of weirdness.
Now, kids are going to do stupid things. They have prior to technology, and they will continue to. But it's alarming that the Chromebooks are smoking up. I mean, are these laptops safe for kids? Should Chromebook be doing something to make it not catch on fire?
So to be clear, we're seeing a little bit of smoke come out because the two sides of the paperclip are touching after receiving power on both sides, and the paperclip itself is heating up, and it is releasing smoke as a result of the protective coating on that paperclip heating up. So the Chromebook itself is not actually catching fire in most cases. The USB ports, there is a design where if power regulation is different in some ways, that it will actually turn off that port, which is what you see happen in a lot of these videos after a couple of seconds of that heat starting to come out. So there are very few cases where something is unsafe enough to cause lasting harm, but this is still not the safest thing in the world, and it does, in some cases, permanently damage those laptops.
Yeah. Now, this Chromebook challenge, my understanding is that TikTok at least tried to take the videos down to try to stop this trend from continuing. Is that right?
Yes, at the request of many, many adults, TikTok has either completely banned all of the videos associated with the hashtag for this, or they have done a version of what is colloquially known as shadow banning, which just makes it so that you have posted the video, but nobody will ever see it.
Okay. Now, a lot of these laptops, when you have a Chromebook, it's usually school issued. So are teachers and principals getting upset? I mean, this is, you know, ruining technology that is given to you at school.
Yes, there have been several news reports all across the U.S. of schools sending home notes with kids or emailing all of the parents asking to educate kids on the hazards associated with damaging this property, as well as making it clear that, you know, the kids and thereby the parents could be financially liable if some of these laptops are permanently damaged. Because while Chromebooks are notoriously inexpensive, that is still, you know, between $300 and $500 that the school had to pay for in order to provide that child with a laptop.
Mm-hmm. Now, before I guess TikTok, I would say one kid would do something bad, the teachers would stop it before any other kids got bad ideas. But with social media, the dynamic's different. I mean, why do trends like this even start? I don't understand how someone would think that this was fun to start a trend of, you know, making your Chromebook smoke.
I mean, it's a combination of boredom and risk. You know, we were all high school students at one point and you know, definitely did very silly things in our, you know, time. I'm not going to tell any particular stories of my childhood, just in case there are kids listening who don't need more bad ideas.
Right.
But yeah, it's, you know, it is in some ways a time-honored tradition, and in other ways, the potential result of boredom or classrooms that are just too large, so teachers aren't able to pay attention to every kid the same way. There are a couple different things that could come from this, but really, you know, there's sort of a general misunderstanding in how some of these computers work, and what may seem relatively fun and harmless could actually be quite dangerous.
Yeah, and there's the whole thing, you know, the school that my kids go to, they stopped letting kids under high school take their Chromebooks home because basically they were just, kids weren't taking care of them because they didn't spend money on it, right? And it was just becoming such a problem. So now only high schoolers are allowed to take their school-issued device home. It was a big change, but it was also just because, I don't know, do kids need to just care about technology, taking care of it a little more?
I mean, there's certainly something to be said for the most recent generation of students in schools not necessarily understanding how the tech that they're using works. They're really good at making sure that, you know, they can start an app and they can, you know, put information inside of those apps. But as far as understanding, you know, how the underlying hardware functions, there's just not the same kind of education as there was, you know, when computers were brand new. Because the focus is more on, you know, teaching other applications instead of how to maintain some of these devices. But yeah, I mean, you see in some school districts, there are waivers that parents have to sign in order for kids to bring those laptops home, you know, making sure that the parents understand the liability there. And others, you know, limit it to high school, as you just said. There's not been, you know, kind of a unified approach here across the country. But there's, you know, there are always different, you know, ways to try and you know, mitigate some of that harm.
Oh, the unified approach that it reminded me of is I was explaining to my kids that we used to have to cover our books. Like you could either buy a book cover or you would make a book cover
That's
out of
exactly
like a paper
right.
bag, right? And that was to keep the books around longer so your social studies book could live on for 10 years. And we got extra credit for covering the books. So I feel like that's what's missing from the school, that they need to like give that same authority, like just, you know, they need to treat the Chromebook the way we treated our books that we covered.
That is exactly right. Yeah. Establishing some level of personal responsibility there, I think, would go a long way.
Yeah. All right. Well, we can move on to our next topic, which is Razer. The famous gaming headphone brand has launched a gaming chair cushion with a speaker system. Are you planning to add this to your gaming setup, Russell?
I am probably not, but I do understand the effort here. Razer has been working really hard for the last couple of years to build They're known for headphones and they're known for keyboards and in some cases even webcams for being able to stream the games that you play to your friends and perhaps a larger audience. But the goal there really is to have kind of the whole gaming area run with Razer products. And so this is kind of the continuation of that. This is a head cushion that goes behind your head. You can attach it to just about any chair, but gaming chairs are what it is designed for. And this adds a dimension of audio directionality and in some cases vibration to go along with the game that you're playing. So if you are playing a game and someone is walking up behind you, you'd be able to feel those footsteps very close to your ears, letting you know that it is behind you so that you can turn around in the game and experience that. Likewise, if there's a particular part of the game where the world is rumbling because there's an earthquake or something like that, that you'd be able to physically feel it more than just the vibration you'd get in a controller or keyboard.
Will these head cushions replace headphones? You don't need headphones if you have this?
I don't know that it would be designed to fully replace headphones so much as provide kind of additional rumble and directionality, but it very much could replace headphones. You could choose to use this as part of a combination with speakers built into your monitor or a sound bar or something like that in order to provide that kind of full distance sound.
Does it have a microphone with it too?
It does not have a microphone with it. This is something that because you're pressing your head up against it, having a microphone would probably dull some of the quality of the audio there.
Now, are the speakers as monumental as they're making them sound? Because they make it sound like this is the best, most impressive speaker that you've ever placed your head near.
Yeah, so CNET's gaming team hasn't been able to test this in, or we have a sound studio where we can actually test, versus other speakers, and we haven't had the opportunity to do that yet. But in the demo, area that was provided, it is an impressive amount of sound that comes out of these speakers, and it was done so in a way that, even if you're, 10 feet away from the speaker, it's far less noticeable, which is, useful if you share a home with other human beings.
Now, could this be used for other than gaming? Could you use this cushion to watch a movie and make it more loud?
That is going to be entirely at the discretion of Razer's software, which is how this works. Is there is a Razer app that you install on your computer, and it helps establish the kind of point to point for where the audio is supposed to come from. And as a part of that experience, it would not surprise me if Razer tied that into work with movies, especially streaming services like Netflix or Max. But so far, that has not been part of this announcement.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and I'm Amy Jarovich, and we're talking about some recent tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. So the app Duolingo is getting rid of the old hearts system and changing to a new energy system. So instead of losing a heart when you get the answer to a question wrong, it's now energy points and it recharges over time. The company says this is to help users with their progress and avoid penalizing people for making mistakes. What has the response been like to this change in Duolingo?
Yeah, so this is specifically for the free version of Duolingo. If you pay for Duolingo, then there's kind of a separate experience that you get there, regarding the kind of achievement system that they have built in here. But I think the idea, as Duolingo has described it, is to reduce the number of people who are discouraged by losing a heart and just close the app. So offering a system that encourages them to continue, learning and continue, frankly, consuming ads while they are playing this essentially gamified version of a language learning system. The energy system, allows you to slowly recharge what you have lost while you continue to learn, especially if you're doing things across more than one language. But yeah, the system here, it has rolled out and so far has been pretty well received, but it does, if you're really familiar with that heart system and it's something that you have kind of built into your kind of daily dopamine intake, then you're going to need to adjust to this new system to get that hit, as it were.
Now, and I understand that you can earn more energy by watching ads. So this makes me feel like there's an ulterior motive here.
Yes, the goal for Duolingo is to keep people using the app as long as possible, and you've seen this through several iterations. There are tons of jokes about the Duolingo bird getting mad at you if you haven't checked in that day. And while making sure that you're being constantly reinforced with new learning techniques is very important, the free version of Duolingo is 100% supported by ads. And so the more ads that you as the user consume, the better it is for Duolingo.
And Duolingo has been the leading language learning app for a long time. So, are there disadvantages to for them making this change? Do you think the app's rating will go down because there's more ads and energy instead of hearts?
I think that anytime you have any kind of change to something that so many people use, there's always going to be some initial resistance. Time will tell whether this is a system that is, going to actually improve the overall experience for users. So far, the response seems fairly positive. And if you look at the app review since the update, there are very few people who have, downrated the app. But it's also important to keep in mind that there's very little scientific evidence to support that Duolingo actually teaches you to learn a new language. It can certainly reinforce existing practices and kind of give you new things, but there is no verified path to fluency through Duolingo. So if you're kind of doing this just because it's a fun thing, then it should continue to be that.
Okay, yeah, I is it, what is Duolingo's main competitors? Are they I don't even know.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases it can be the Rosetta Stone platform, and there are a few other kind of daily learning tools that are not nearly as popular, but are often encouraged in things like school environments. So it varies depending on what specific language you want to know. What Duolingo offers really is just how massive the program is. It has a really substantial language catalog, and every once in a while they toss some cool things in there to make people happy. Like if you want to learn one of the languages from Star Wars or something like that, then sometimes during the year it'll pop up as like a temporary thing that you can add to your current learning. So I mean, it is known for being quite fun. And after all of the excitement late last year, where the mascot for Duolingo passed away and was resurrected, it's clear that this group has quite a few fans that are willing to jump on and have fun every day.
Well, we have a few minutes left, Russell, and I wanted to ask you, CNET has a daily tariff price tracker. You're tracking things like Xbox and I guess Nintendo, other things like that, to see if the tariffs are impacting the price. What have you been seeing with that lately?
Oh gosh, yeah. What we've seen, the team there has been checking, a couple times a day to see, across multiple retailers to see what the, kind of price changes are from retailer to retailer. And the one this week that we have seen that has been, kind of one of the most surprising changes has been printer ink from HP specifically. Saw an 8% increase starting Friday for almost all of the inks that HP makes. The same cannot be true said of the third party inks that work with HP printers. Those have maintained the same price. So if you find the price for that ink has gone up in a way that is difficult for you, then I would recommend looking for approved third parties that are still in those same prices. But yeah, the fluctuations across all of these, that's why pretty regularly when we come on here, I talk about the free app for Chrome called Keepa, Keepa, which will give you a pricing history as you scroll on Amazon to let you know what those prices are. But for things that are not available on Amazon, that's why we have that tariff tracker.
Yeah. You were on a few weeks ago talking about how Nintendo's new system, you didn't know what it was going to cost because they didn't know what to price it at because they didn't know what was happening with the tariffs. Is there still no price on it?
We do have a price on it. It's $450 for the US. But if you are curious about, what the potential impact of tariffs are there, that same console in Japan is only $300.
Interesting. Okay. And are you, I mean, obviously, things with tariffs seem to change on the daily. So, have you been seeing things change on the daily with this tracker?
That's what's really interesting, right? Is that there's a difference between, there seems to be a pretty significant difference between announcement and implementation. So the administration may come out and say, hey, we're going to, enact these tariffs, but they don't maybe take effect right away. And even if they do take effect right away, a lot of the pricing won't change until stock that already exists here in the US has been depleted. So I suspect we'll see more of that pricing volatility here within the next 30 days, based on some of the changes that had happened previously. But yeah, this is something that we're gonna track throughout the summer because it seems like those changes are gonna be fairly common.
Yeah, well, and the really high tariffs with China have been walked back, at least temporarily for I don't know if it's 30 days or 90 days. No one can keep up. But so will we see the price go up if there's like a 30-day lag? Will we see the price go up and then it'll go back down and then it could go up again?
Yeah, honestly, it's going to be really interesting to see. In some cases, the price adjustments have happened across entire catalogs. This is typically the time of year where Hallmark, as a company, releases the lookbook for ornaments that are going to be available at the end of the year. And if you go into a store right now, there is a sheet attached to that Hallmark lookbook with updated prices because the book was published before the tariffs came out. And in some cases, those price increases are upwards of 20% across the entire store.
That is so interesting. So tariffs hit everything, including Hallmark ornaments.
That
Wow.
seems to be the case.
All
Either
right.
that or the company is, taking advantage of the moment, but
Oh,
we'll see.
well, I guess we'll see. All right. Well, that was Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for joining us, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thank you to our staff, Senior Producer Marcus Charleston, Producer Aaron Esmont-Robinowitz, our student producers, Chris Corcoran, David Stein, Iza Huck, and Colin Simpson. We have video production by The Ohio Channel and board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. And thank you for listening. This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jorovich.